Peter Carey has had great success writing about characters that break the law. My Life is a Fake was about a literary fraud. He stole the criminal protagonist of his novel Jack Maggs from Dickens' Great Expectations, and he won one of his two Booker Prizes for True History of the Kelly Gang. His latest theft uses art fraud to tell the story of an uneasy love affair and an uneasy relationship between two brothers. Theft is published by Knopf, and it brings Peter Carey back to my show today. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Nice to see you, Leonard.
I know that writers of fiction hate the how much of this is autobiographical question, but there are certain similarities between you and your protagonist, Michael Butcher Boone. For example, you were both born in the same Australian town, Bacchus Marsh, and in the same year, 1943. Is that just a coincidence?
No, it's not a coincidence, but I would, you know, of course I'm prickling at the whole, you know, autobiographical thing. I've spent a week pointing out to people the difference between biography and geography. But certainly I came from Bacchus Marsh, and certainly I used it, and certainly I made this rather large gentleman be born in the year I was born, and really because I wanted to be sure what things were happening in that little town at that time, and so I could rely on my memory, and I could rely on what would be within his father's memory, and so on. But so that's why I did it.
I also thought, since this is a book that concerns itself about the process of creating art, you might want your readers to conjecture about your own creation process.
Well, yeah. Oh, you mean in doing that?
Yeah.
Oh, no. No, no. I never think that anyone's going to think those things at all. I just, you know, I'm just looking around for what's handy, what's handy and usable.
If I were an Australian reader, would the fact that this character and his brother are from Bacchus Marsh have given me some clue as to what they are all about?
Well, if you're an Australian reader, you might even not know where Bacchus Marsh was if you were from another state, for instance. But it would probably indicate...
It's not a small town.
Sorry?
It's not a small town.
Oh, well, in the period of this book, when I was born, there were 4,000 people who lived there. So it is small. And but I think people would generally understand that it would be one of those small Australian country towns with a, you know, a police station, a courthouse, and seven pubs, you know, and that it would be of a certain size, and it would be a place where, well, it might be a library, but it's not a town of books, and it's not a town of paintings, and you can, as I did, you know, I grew up there, and I didn't see an original oil painting, let alone any other substance, until I was about 18.
When you left town and went to school?
I went to school. I didn't see too many paintings at school, although it was a very expensive school. No, after I went to Melbourne, failed at university, and got a job in an advertising agency. There is where culture begins.
Much of this book is about the relationship of Michael, the painter, a painter who was once prominent and his reputation has since gone into decline, and his what he calls his damaged 220-pound brother. He's kind of house-sitting at the beginning, and he's also looking after his brother. Were they there from the start? Duo there from the start?
No, the brother wasn't. And in the end, of course, the brother, the damaged brother, Hugh, is the one I'm, in a way, if I can play favorites, is the one I'm most proud of and whose language I'm most delighted by. But at the very beginning, I'd worked out this whole story, which was to do with the artist, and it was going to involve, you know, a fraud, and I'd worked out this whole story. And I wrote the first two chapters. And I like to have different points of view in books. I mean, I've always done this. And the Kelly Gang was different. It was basically one point of view, but one wants another point of view to challenge the authority of the narrator. And so that's where Hugh was born. And he was sort of born because I wanted somewhere for Butcher, who complains and whines and is so angry, I wanted to show that actually Butcher was actually looking after somebody as well. And I wanted somebody to undercut all his bombast.
And so we have not alternating chapters because Butcher gets to tell much of the story, but we get Hugh often enough, maybe, what, one out of three or so?
I didn't know.
There's kind of a conversation they're having with each other. Mm. And we have to try to figure out who's telling the truth here and who's telling the truth where and what to trust here and what to trust there.
I don't know. I mean, I doubt it's too hard.
we figure it out.
we can show that Hugh probably overestimates his role in the production of art and helping his brother, and we can be sure at the same time that, he matters not at all in his brother's telling of the tale. We're all unreliable narrators, I think. Yeah, somebody said to me the other day, "Why do you have unreliable narrators?" Well, I've never met a reliable one in my life.
But you are somebody who studied sciences when you went to college. Something quite science is all about fact and truth. Is that the reason you abandoned the sciences?
What a rotten question. I was just thinking how complimentary you were being in saying that I studied science.
Well, you were a science major.
Well,
weren't you?
Yeah, I was admitted to university. And
then you went to advertising, yeah. Where you obviously learned how to lie.
Oh, come on! So the whole business about my total failure with science was really that I got to university and didn't understand a word they were saying, and I was doomed as a scientist. You know, that was clear pretty quickly. So I started hanging out with the zoologists, who at least read poetry and had some culture and so on. And then you're right, and I got a job in an advertising agency. But the advertising agency was filled with writers. And by the way, just to complicate it a little bit, its chief executive officer was a former member of the Communist Party of Australia. And so it wasn't quite what you want. When you think of Madison Avenue, it really wasn't quite like that.
Well, we have two other major characters here. We have the love interest, Marlene, and we also have Australia. Can we call Australia a major character in this book?
Well, yes, I suppose so.
You've lived in...
Today, yes.
You've lived in New York for many years. Are you still trying to work out your feelings about your homeland?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think it's to do with working out my feelings so much, which would suggest for me something I would shy away from, which was any sort of therapeutic intent in the making of the work. But I am still obsessed with it. I did live there for what, I don't know, nearly 50 years. It's bound to have had a huge effect on me, and I know things deep in myself and feel things deep in myself about that country that I could never, ever feel about New York City. In New York, I can find my way around, but can I ever? I mean, I was with Richard Price the other night, and he was reading. I mean, can I know New York like he does? Not, never. And or DeLillo, you know? No, of course not. So I can write about it from the outside.
Well, you do have this book, Moved to New York, London, Tokyo. Also Sydney, which seems to be as much a foreign city from Bacchus Marsh as New York and Tokyo might be.
Well, yes, and actually it's interesting to talk about all of these things in the sense that you're asking me, can I write, implicitly asking me, can I write about New York, will I write about New York, and so on. You didn't quite ask that, I know.
No, I asked you that in the past, but I've given up.
Yeah, all right. But I do remember going to live in Sydney from Melbourne and thinking, I can't write about Sydney. You know, it's not my place. And in the end, I did. I got over that. But I think this is a bigger jump.
In this case, he winds up going to Japan because he has an exhibition. Were you working on this novel when you went to Japan with your son, the story you wrote about in Wrong About Japan?
No, I wasn't. The reason Japan comes into the book is as I'm researching, you know, the business of the art world and art theft and fraud and so on, I really basically want to find a good place to launder a painting, the painting that's been stolen, a perhaps fake painting that's been stolen in Australia, and where can I have it born again? And my informant suggested numbers of things, but Japan seemed interesting because I thought I knew enough to be able to do that.
Your informant, because you were talking to artists about what it's like to be an artist and how to paint a painting and how the art world works. Is it all that different from being a writer? Is the world of artists and art dealers much different from writers and publishers?
Oh, well, I think it probably is. I think the business of making a painting surely is hugely different, you know, in the sheer physicality of the business. Then in the art world, you need a very small number of people, really, to make a reputation. They have to be very particular people, rich people or influential. But in the world of literature, of course, you know, you need a lot more people. So maybe the decisions are, we can say, not to misuse the word, are slightly more democratic or broadly based in some way. And I have the sort of the sense of artists, older artists particularly, who've been through this process and worked so hard and given their lives for it all, being more generally embittered, perhaps, than older writers are. And their contempt for the market and the modern opinion seems slightly more extreme than writers. Not that we don't have this too.
My guest is Peter Carey, whose latest novel is Theft. It's published by Knopf. Well, the reason I asked is because Theft deals with fraud in the art world, and My Life is a Hoax was about literary forgery. And so I started thinking about authentic things. Marlene, the love interest, plays the role of an art authenticator. And then I thought, what about Australia? Isn't it also an invention? Because the Australian history, among other things, is a denial of 40,000 years of Aboriginal history.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think we all are, and we are the stories and we are the lies we tell ourselves. And Australia is, built on that sort of very simple fraudulent claim that there's a law of terra nullius, which declares that the land was not being used when the British came there and claimed it.
Very convenient.
Rubbish, of course. I mean, people had been living there for 50,000 years very satisfactorily. And so the whole of the nation does exist on that line. And then I think there are other sort of more deep but sort of more less legal sort of lies that we tell each other that beginning the European phase of settlement with a penal colony had no real effect on us now. Well, of course, it seems to me, and I've said this to you before, I think it's like the Mayflower, those folks on the Mayflower affect this country to this day. Well, just imagine if the Mayflower had been filled with soldiers and criminals and had been torn from their country, not sought another country, then that will affect the country to this day. So, yes, and there's a lot of denial, enormous amount of denial. People were working on this all the time. And what happened, I was brought up to believe the Aboriginal people never fought and didn't really want their land anyway, and that in New Zealand the Maoris really fought and they were fierce. Well, there were wars. There was a war, a whole series of wars that were fought in Australia, which we still don't like to think about too much.
You talked about falling in love with Hugh's voice when you started writing it. How different was that than creating Ned Kelly's voice?
Well, Ned Kelly's voice was born from a letter that Ned Kelly wrote, and a letter that I carried in my mind for something like 20 or more years. An unpunctuated, passionate, sometimes very funny, sometimes a little bit mad document that he left to justify his life. And with typical naivete, left it when he robbed the bank, with instructions to the printer to print it and distribute it. Well, of course it was never distributed. But anyway, this was a wonderful document, and I thought I would really like to write his story in a voice very close to that. So that's where that comes from. Hugh's voice, I do sort of know where Hugh's voice comes from, actually.
Because you don't tell us what his condition is, and I assume you did that on purpose.
Well,
you hint at some form of autism because he bites his fingers and hurts himself by headbanging, wonders whether he's an idiot savant.
Mm. I've got to get a diagnosis number for him. What's that book?
It doesn't
the Merck manual? I've got to do that. I don't.
Maybe it doesn't matter.
I've got all sorts of answers for the question, but I don't really want to give any of them. So.
But you didn't want to pin him down.
No, I think things that I've done things in the past where normally, I would go into really research a condition. Tristan Smith has a very particular condition, and I spend a lot of time, really researching his condition with doctors and so on. In this case, I didn't do that at all. So Hugh is a free-floating invention, let's say. That's what I think he is.
We have, you've also called this book a love story. And it's a love story between the brothers as much as it is between Butcher and Marlene on purpose.
Isn't this one of the weird things?
And then there's love of art, there's love of greed, especially by the art dealers.
Well, I'd put the love of art very, very high in that. And love between the brothers, which was the great discovery for me in writing the book, very, very high too. And the love... you know, for Marlene and Marlene, also for Butcher and his brother to be high.
And a love of language, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes.
That is something that people have always remarked about your work, and you're one of those rare writers who writes in with fabulous language who didn't start as a poet.
No, and I didn't, but you know, the thing that made me love literature in the beginning were writers like it was Faulkner and it was Joyce and it was Beckett, and I think it took me something like 20 years to get to the place where I could begin to do the thing that I wanted to do in the very beginning, and to be confident enough that I could break the rules and that it would work and that I wasn't doing it gratuitously.
And what are you working on now? Another novel?
Another book tour. No, I'm working on another novel, which I haven't written a word of since February because I've been talking about myself too much.
Well, do the book tours bother you?
You know, I used to love them. I used to say to all my friends, I don't see what you're complaining about. You know, nice hotels, you don't have to pay for everything, you're a baby. But I've really finally had enough, I think.
Well, despite that, I thank you for coming by and talking with me today. Peter Carey. His latest novel, Theft, A Love Story, is published by Knopf.